Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 23rd, Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19 in Colorado. Three counties enact mask mandates by Meg Wingerter and Sam Tabachnik. Aurora Police Union, president suspended over diversity email by the Associated Press. Biden to keep Powell as Fed chair by Christopher Rugeber. Five killed in Christmas parade crash, police suspect was in a domestic disturbance by Scott Bauer, Michael Balsamo, and Mike Householder. And following up with miscellaneous articles. COVID-19 in Colorado. Three counties enact mask mandates. Jefferson, Adams, and Arapahoe to require facial coverings. By Meg Wingerter and Sam Tabachnik, The Denver Post. The boards of health for three Metro Denver counties voted Monday to require almost everyone to once again wear masks in indoor public spaces, part of a coordinated push to take action against the troubling COVID-19 trends that county health officials say they've been forced to address without a statewide mandate. The orders require adults and most children in Jefferson, Adams, and Arapahoe counties to wear masks in indoor public spaces, including retail stores, restaurants, and gyms, beginning Wednesday, though businesses can seek exemptions if they require their employees and customers to be vaccinated. If the state is unwilling to act, metro-wide action to implement mask mandates can provide some benefit given the size of our population and number of hospitalizations, said Dr. John Douglas, executive director for the Tri-County Health Department, which covers Adams and Arapahoe counties. Boulder, Pitkin, and Larimer counties already have indoor mask mandates in place. Generally, the metro area counties try to sync up their public health orders. Bob McDonald, executive director of Denver's Department of Public Health and Environment, said the city would announce some things on Tuesday related to its strategy to fight COVID-19, but he didn't specify what they might be. Douglas County, which still contracts with Tri-County for routine public health services, has resisted any efforts to reinstate mask mandates to the point of setting up its own public health board. The Jeffco public health order, adopted by a 4-1 vote, will remain in place until the number of new COVID-19 cases in the county drops to a certain level. The Tri-County order for Adams and Arapahoe counties, which passed by a 5-1 margin, will remain in effect until January 2nd and beyond, as long as ICU capacity remains low. The intent of this order is to slow the spread, so we don't have any unnecessary deaths, and so we can preserve our hospital capacity, Jeffco board member Kimberly Kripek said. Sherry John, who cast the sole dissenting vote on Jeffco's Board of Health, said she didn't like the idea of making businesses responsible for enforcing mask mandates on a public that she said is increasingly frustrated with pandemic health orders. "I think that is putting a lot of strain on businesses," she said. Strain on state's hospitals. Hospitalizations in Larimer County have fallen by about 1/3 since it implemented its mask mandate, said Don Comstock, executive director of Jefferson County Public Health. Neighboring Weld County's hospitalizations haven't fallen, suggesting masks are making a difference, she said. Statewide, COVID-19 hospitalizations rose to 1,565 on Monday afternoon, with 635 general beds and 81 intensive care beds still available. close to half of hospitals reporting to the state, 46%, said they expected to be short-staffed in the next week. The week ending Sunday appeared to have almost 2,000 fewer new coronavirus cases than the previous week. That gap likely will narrow as delayed reports come in, though. COVID-19 deaths continued to rise in Colorado last week, reaching levels seen at the worst point of April 2020 in the first week of November. There are some hopeful signs, though, as the number of new cases and the percentage of tests coming back positive dropped over the last few days, said Dr. John Salmon, dean of the Colorado School of Public Health. But he said it's too early to know if that's a trend or random fluctuation in the numbers. Last year, there wasn't a significant bump in cases post-Thanksgiving, and hospitalizations peaked in early December. But it's not clear if Colorado will follow the same path this year, Samet said. This year could be different because it appears that far more people are going to be traveling, he said. The Tri-County Order for Adams and Arapahoe Counties applies to anyone 2 and older, while Jeffco's order starts at age 3. Both orders also exempt people who are actively eating or drinking at restaurants, who have medical conditions that prevent them from wearing masks, who rely on lip reading for communication, who are performers in a show or leaders of a religious service if they're 12 feet from others, or who are participating in individual sports like gymnastics if they're 25 feet from others. Not a forever policy. The Jeffco County mandate will be in effect until the county has had fewer than 50 cases for every 100,000 people for 3 weeks straight, and fewer than 8% of COVID-19 tests are positive. At that point, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention deems transmission moderate and no longer recommends requiring vaccinated people to wear masks. As of Monday, Jefferson County had 345.2 cases for every 100,000 people over the previous week, and an average of 10.5% of tests were positive. The order for Adams and Arapahoe counties will remain in effect through January 2nd, and then until at least 10% of ICU bed capacity is available for 14 consecutive days. Adams County had 7.5% of ICU capacity available on Monday, and Arapahoe County had no ICU beds available, according to Tri-County data. This is not a forever policy, Douglas said. It's directly tied to the crisis facing today. The increase in cases this fall has led to growing hospitalizations. Jefferson County's rate of hospitalizations compared to population is about 9 times what it was early in July, 2.41 per 100,000 people as of mid-November, compared to 0.26 per 100,000 in the summer. Jefferson County already required masks in schools, childcare facilities, and county-owned buildings. People also have to mask up in nursing homes and jails and on public transit because of state and federal rules. Multiple metro area health departments, including Jefferson County's, sent a letter asking Governor Jared Polis to enact a statewide mask mandate, but Comstock acknowledged that was very unlikely. Polis has repeatedly said any decisions on masks should happen locally. Public input on masks. Hundreds of people signed up to speak at the Jeffco Board of Health's virtual meeting, though the public comment period was limited to 2 hours. Many were business owners who didn't want to be tasked with enforcing a mandate. Fitness club owners had a particularly strong showing, asking for an exemption for fear their clients would cross county lines or stop exercising altogether. Parker Brown, a Westminster businessman, said he's not opposed to a mask mandate, but doesn't want his employees to be responsible for enforcing it. How do I ask my staff to sit there and debate with the customers when they're 17 years old? He said. A significant number of commenters shared scientifically inaccurate information. A handful compared allowing businesses to require vaccines to racial segregation. John also raised concerns about whether the order would criminalize business owners who were uncomfortable asking customers to wear masks. "We're putting them in control of people they have no control over," she said. Comstock said enforcement will focus on educating business owners and encouraging them to comply, and that most learned to live with the statewide mask mandate last year. "This is not something businesses have never dealt with," she said. Aurora Police Union: President suspended over diversity email, by the Associated Press. The president of a police union in Aurora has been placed on paid administrative leave by the police department after he sent an email to the group's 240 members calling diversity provisions in an agreement between the city and the state sexist and racist. Officer Doug Wilkerson sent the email November 16th and was placed on leave the following day after multiple Aurora officers complained to Human Resources. Lieutenant Chris Amsler, an aide to Aurora Police Chief Vanessa Wilson, told KCNC-TV, "To match the diversity of the community, we can make sure to hire 10% illegal aliens, 50% weed smokers, 10% crackheads, and a few child molesters and murderers to round it out. You know, so we can make the department look like the community," Wilkerson wrote in an email. The email was prompted by an agreement announced November 16th that set up reforms for the Aurora Police and Fire Departments. The consent decree followed a lengthy state investigation that found a pattern of racist policing and excessive use of force. It calls for updated hiring practices so the police and fire departments better reflect the city's racial makeup. The investigation was launched amid outrage over the death of Elijah McClain, a 23-year-old black man who was put into a chokehold by Aurora police and injected by paramedics with ketamine in 2019. Wilkerson told KCNC-TV his missive was intended to be a private email message to the members and should not have been made public. "I'm trying to have an honest conversation without it becoming a word salad," he said. Wilkerson's email criticized the agreement's provisions for diversity in hiring and promotions within the police department. The decree indicates that they want to replace as many of the department's white males as possible with as many women and minorities, he wrote. "It's as simple as that. To do that, they are going to hire and promote non-whites and non-males wherever they can." According to Wilkerson, the state's plan, fully embraced by the city, is literally systematically sexist and racist. He also wrote that he would prefer that the department focus on intelligence, personal ethics, and courage as the only criteria for hiring and promotion. "That's all I care about. We should only be interested in merit. But that will never do. They're addicted to race and sex politics. We already hire every minority that passes the minimum requirements," he wrote. Amsler said the police chief is very concerned about the email and added that the Aurora Police Association does not speak for the police department and is not the recognized bargaining unit with the city. The APA is one of two Aurora police unions. The Fraternal Order of Police represents the majority of Aurora officers. Biden to keep Powell as Fed chair. Brainard is selected as the vice chair, by Christopher Rugaber, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. President Joe Biden said Monday he is nominating Jerome Powell for a second four-year term as Federal Reserve chair, endorsing his stewardship of the economy through a brutal pandemic recession in which the Fed's ultra-low rate policies helped bolster confidence and revitalize the job market. Biden also said he would nominate as vice chair Lael Brainard, the lone Democrat on the Fed's Board of Governors and the preferred alternative to Powell among many progressives. His decision strikes a note of continuity and bipartisanship at a time when surging inflation is burdening households and raising risks to the economy's recovery. In backing Powell, a Republican who was elevated to his post by President Donald Trump, Biden brushed aside complaints from progressives that the Fed has weakened bank regulation and has been slow to take account of climate change in its supervision of banks. When our country was hemorrhaging jobs last year, and there was panic in our financial markets, Jay's steady and decisive leadership helped to stabilize markets and put our economy on track to a robust recovery, Biden said, using Powell's nickname. In a second term that begins in February, Powell would face a difficult and high-risk balancing act. Inflation has reached a three-decade high, causing hardships for millions of families, clouding the recovery, and undercutting the Fed's mandate to keep prices stable. But with the economy still 4 million plus jobs shy of its pre-pandemic level, the Fed has yet to meet its other mandate of maximizing employment. Next year, the Fed is widely expected to begin raising its benchmark interest rate, with financial markets pricing in at least 2 increases. If it moves too slowly to raise rates, inflation may accelerate further and force the central bank to take more draconian steps later to rein it in, potentially causing a recession. Yet if the Fed hikes rates too quickly, it could choke off hiring and the recovery. If confirmed, Powell would remain one of the world's most powerful economic officials. By either raising or lowering its short-term interest rate, the Fed seeks to either cool or stimulate growth and hiring, and to keep prices stable. Its efforts to direct the U.S. economy, the largest in the world, typically have global consequences. The Fed's benchmark rate, which has been pegged near zero since the pandemic hammered the economy in March 2020, influences a wide range of consumer and business borrowing costs, including for mortgages and credit cards. The Fed also oversees the nation's largest banks. For months, Powell was the favorite to be reappointed, but a vigorous campaign by environmental and public interest groups in support of Brainard clouded the picture in recent weeks. Critics, including Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, argue Powell had loosened bank regulations that were put in place after the 2008-2009 financial crisis. And two other senators expressed opposition to Powell last week because they said he was insufficiently committed to using the Fed's regulatory tools to combat global warming. Brainard, meanwhile, cast 20 dissenting votes against financial rule changes in the past 4 years. In March 2020, she opposed a regulatory change that she said would reduce the amount of reserves large banks were required to hold to guard against losses. She has also spoken more forcefully than Powell on ways the Fed can confront global warming. Biden sought to assuage those concerns. He said Powell had committed to making climate change a top priority and had agreed to make sure that our financial regulations are staying ahead of emerging risks. Jay, along with the other members of the Fed board that I will nominate, must ensure that we will never again expose our economy and American families to those kinds of risks, he said at the White House, referring to the 2008 financial crisis. Biden still has the opportunity to fill 3 more positions on the Fed's Board of Governors, including the Vice Chair for Supervision, a top bank regulatory post. Those positions will be filled in early December, Biden said. 5 killed in Christmas parade crash. Police, suspect, was in a domestic disturbance. By Scott Bauer, Michael Balsamo, and Mike Householder, The Associated Press, byline, Waukesha, Wisconsin. The SUV driver who plowed into a Christmas parade in suburban Milwaukee, killing at least 5 people and injuring 48, was leaving the scene of a domestic dispute that had taken place just minutes earlier, Waukesha's police chief said Monday. Police Chief Dan Thompson said there was no evidence the bloodshed Sunday was a terrorist attack or that the suspect, Daryl Brooks Jr., knew anyone in the parade. Brooks acted alone, the chief said. Brooks, 39, of Milwaukee, had left the site of a domestic disturbance before officers arrived and was not being chased by police at the time of the crash, according to the chief, who gave no further details on the dispute. Police said they were drawing up 5 charges of intentional homicide against Brooks. He has been charged with crimes 16 times since 1999 and had two outstanding cases against him at the time of the parade disaster, including one in which he was accused of deliberately running down a woman with his vehicle. On Sunday, a joyous scene of marching bands and children dancing in Santa hats and waving pom-poms gave way in an instant to screams and the sight of crumpled bodies as the SUV sped through barricades and struck dancers, musicians, and others in the community of 72,000. The dead were identified as four women, ages 52 to 79, and an 81-year-old man. Members of a Dancing Grannies Club were among those killed, as was a bank employee. Mayor Sean Riley described the parade as a Norman Rockwell-type event that became a nightmare. "It looked like dummies being thrown in the air," said Nicole Schneider, who was there with her children and grandchildren. "It took a second to register, like, is that what we really just saw? And then you looked in the road, and there were just people laying in the road." At least nine patients, most of them children, were listed in critical condition at two hospitals, and seven others were reported in serious condition. The chief said that while police were not pursuing Brooks before he entered the parade route, an officer did fire a shot to try to stop him, but ceased shooting because of the danger to others. Brooks was not injured. Brooks has two open criminal cases in Milwaukee County. In one case, filed November 5th, he is charged with resisting or obstructing an officer, reckless endangering, disorderly conduct, bail jumping, and battery. Records show his $1,000 cash bond was posted on Friday. In that case, a woman told police that Brooks deliberately ran her over with his vehicle in a gas station parking lot after a fight. She was hospitalized for her injuries. In the other case, filed in July 2020, Brooks is charged with reckless endangering and illegal possession of a firearm. His attorney in those cases, Joseph Domask, said he was not representing him in the parade crash. The Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office said prosecutors' $1,000 bail recommendation for Brooks was inappropriately low, given the charges. The DA's office said it is investigating the matter. Republican Rebecca Clefish, a former Wisconsin lieutenant governor who is running for governor in 2022, called the killings yet another avoidable tragedy that occurred because a violent career criminal was allowed to walk free and terrorize our community. Brooks is an aspiring rapper. On a YouTube page, a video that has since been removed showed him rapping in front of a red Ford SUV resembling the one at the parade. The rapper uses the name MathBoyFly on his Twitter and other social media accounts. The horror of the crash was recorded by the city's live stream and onlookers' cell phones. One video shows the moment the SUV broke through the barricades and includes the apparent sound of gunfire. "It was like a war scene walking through there afterward," said Ken Walter, who had been riding in the parade in a hot air balloon basket, towed on a trailer along with his wife and youngest son. "There were these piles of blankets with cops standing over them that you just knew were bodies." Walter said he saw a red SUV careen into view and watched it hit a member of his real estate agency parade contingent, then barrel straight into members of the Waukesha South High School marching band. The SUV continued down the parade route. Behind it, people were screaming, running, searching for family and friends, and unsure whether they were still in danger, he recalled. Schneider said that after sheltering in a store, she emerged to see bodies in the street, along with strollers, chairs, candy, and shoes. The police identified those killed as Virginia Sorensen, 79, Leanna Owen, 71, Tamara Durand, 52, Jane Coolidge, 52, and Wilhelm Hospel, 81. The Milwaukee Dancing Grannies posted on its Facebook page that its members were doing what they loved, performing in front of crowds in a parade, putting smiles on faces of all ages, filling them with joy and happiness. 18 children ages 3 to 16 were brought to Children's Wisconsin Hospital, including three sets of siblings, said Dr. Amy Drendel, medical director of the emergency department. They suffered injuries ranging from scrapes on their faces to broken bones and serious head injuries, she said. Six were listed in critical condition. January 6th, U.S. Capitol insurrection. House panel subpoenas Alex Jones and Roger Stone. By Farnoosh Amiri. The Associated Press. Byline, Washington. A committee investigating the January 6th U.S. Capitol insurrection issued subpoenas Monday to five more individuals, including former President Donald Trump's ally, Roger Stone, and conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, as lawmakers deepened their probe of the rallies that preceded the deadly attack. The subpoenas include demands for documents and testimony from Stone and Jones, as well as three people accused of organizing and promoting the two rallies that took place on January 6th. The Select Committee is seeking information about the rallies and subsequent march to the Capitol that escalated into a violent mob attacking the Capitol and threatening our democracy, said Mississippi Representative Benny Thompson, the Democratic chairman of the panel. We need to know who organized, planned, paid for, and received funds related to those events, as well as what communication organizers had with officials in the White House and Congress. The subpoenas issued Monday are the latest in a wide net the House panel has cast in an effort to investigate the deadly day when a group of Trump supporters, fueled by his false claims of a stolen election, brutally assaulted police and smashed their way into the Capitol to interrupt the certification of Democrat Joe Biden's victory. The committee has already interviewed more than 150 people across government, social media, and law enforcement, including some former Trump aides who had been cooperative. The panel has subpoenaed more than 20 witnesses, and most of them, including several associates who helped plan the massive Stop the Steal rally the morning of January 6, have signaled they will cooperate. Stone was convicted in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation of lying to Congress about his efforts to gather inside information about Russia-hacked Democratic emails that were published by WikiLeaks in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election. He was subsequently pardoned by Trump. The House subpoena notes that Stone spoke at rallies on the day before the Capitol insurrection and used members of a far-right group, the Oath Keepers, as personal security guards while he was in Washington. In a statement, Stone said he has yet to see the details of the subpoena, but called any allegation of his involvement on that day as categorically false. I have said time and time again that I had no advance knowledge of the events that took place at the Capitol on that day, the conservative provocateur said. After the subpoena is served, and after my counsel reviews the request, I will make the determination of how I will proceed. The House panel also wants to hear from Jones, with Thompson saying that conspiracy theorists and talk show hosts helped organize the January 6 rally at the Ellipse before the insurrection. The letter from Thompson says that Jones repeatedly promoted Trump's claims of election fraud, urged his listeners to come to Washington for the rally, and march from the Ellipse to the Capitol. A lawyer who has represented Jones previously did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The other three subpoenas were issued to Dustin Stockton, Jennifer Lawrence, and Taylor Budowich for their alleged involvement in the promotion and organization of the series of rallies following the 2020 presidential election that promoted false information regarding the election results, including the Ellipse rally that preceded the violent attack on the Capitol. Attorneys make final case in Ahmaud Arbery's death. By Russ Bynum, The Associated Press, byline Brunswick, Georgia. Attorneys made a final push Monday to persuade the jury in the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, with the prosecution saying that three white men chased him solely because he was a black man running down the street, and defense attorneys repeatedly blaming Arbery for his own death. In closing arguments, a defense attorney for the man who fired the fatal gunshots said the 25-year-old Arbery was killed as he violently resisted a legal effort to detain him to answer questions about burglaries in a neighborhood just outside the port city of Brunswick, Georgia. It is absolutely horrifically tragic that this has happened, Attorney Jason Sheffield said. This is where the law is intertwined with heartache and tragedy. You are allowed to defend yourself. The attorneys made their appeals to the disproportionately white jury after 10 days of testimony that concluded last week. Closing arguments were to resume Tuesday. Prosecutors will get the final word because they carry the burden of proving their case beyond a reasonable doubt. Arbery's killing became part of a larger national reckoning on social injustice after a graphic video of his death leaked online 2 months later. Though prosecutors did not argue that racism motivated the killing, federal authorities have charged all three men with hate crimes, alleging that they chased and killed Arbery because he was black. Father and son Greg and Travis McMichael grabbed guns and pursued Arbery in a pickup truck after spotting him running through their subdivision on February 23, 2020. A neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, joined the chase and recorded the video of Travis McMichael opening fire as Arbery threw punches and grabbed for his shotgun. No one was charged in the killing until Bryan's video leaked and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation took over the case from local police. All three men are charged with murder and other offenses. Prosecutor Linda Dinikowski told the jury that defendants had no evidence Arbery committed crimes, but instead acted on assumptions based on neighborhood gossip and speculative social media posts. They made the decision to attack Ahmaud Arbery in their driveways because he was a black man running down the street, Dinikowski said. She added, they shot and killed him, not because he was a threat to them, but because he wouldn't stop and talk to them. Defense attorneys say the men suspected Arbery had burglarized a house under construction and intended to hold him until police arrived. Security cameras recorded Arbery inside the house 5 times, but none of the videos showed him stealing or damaging anything. Dinikowski said the McMichaels and Bryan chased Arbery for 5 minutes, using their trucks to cut him off, run him off the road, and otherwise prevent him from fleeing. In news briefs, overwhelming evidence Cuomo engaged in harassment. An 8-month investigation by the New York State Assembly found overwhelming evidence that former Governor Andrew Cuomo engaged in sexual harassment while in office and abused his power to help produce what would become a $5.1 million pandemic memoir. The findings reinforce a damning investigation by the state attorney general that concluded that Cuomo had sexually harassed 11 women, including a former aide whose allegation of groping is now the subject of a criminal complaint. The assembly inquiry was meant to create a roadmap for potential impeachment proceedings against Cuomo, a 3-term governor whose unrelenting style of leadership engendered varying amounts of fear, respect, and hatred. But that prospect was rendered moot after he resigned in disgrace in August. Still, the 46-page report released Monday went beyond the sexual harassment accusations, further damaging Cuomo's legacy and his continued attempts to preserve it. Justice Department to pay about $130 million to Parkland shooting victims, Byline, Miami. The Justice Department will pay about $130 million to 40 survivors and families of victims in the 2018 massacre at a high school in Parkland, Florida, over the FBI's failure to properly investigate 2 tips in the months before the shooting that suggested the gunman might open fire at a school. One of the tips, 6 weeks before the shooting, detailed how the gunman, Nicholas Cruz, was posting on Instagram about amassing weapons and ammunition. I know he's going to explode, the woman said on the FBI's tip line, adding that she feared Cruz, then 19, was going to slip into a school and start shooting the place up. 40 days later, Cruz did just that, killing 17 people and injuring 17 others at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where he had previously been a student. Spacey was ordered to pay $31 million after sexual harassment allegations. An arbitrator ruled last year that Kevin Spacey and his production companies owe MRC, the studio behind the Netflix series House of Cards, nearly $31 million for breach of contract following numerous sexual harassment allegations against the actor. The secret arbitrator's ruling, which was issued 13 months ago, was made public on Monday when lawyers from MRC petitioned a California court to confirm the award. While the sixth and final season was being filmed in 2017, actor Anthony Rapp accused Spacey of making a sexual advance toward him in 1986 when Rapp was 14. MRC and Netflix suspended production on the series while they investigated. Ex-South Korean strongman Chun-Do Hwan dies, byline Seoul. Former South Korean military strongman Chun-Do Hwan, who took power in a 1979 coup and brutally crushed pro-democracy protests before going to prison for misdeeds in office, died on Tuesday. He was 90. Emergency officials said Chun died at his home. Police earlier said Chun suffered a cardiac arrest and emergency officials rushed to his Seoul residence. Hundreds of pro-democracy protesters were killed and tens of thousands were imprisoned during Chun's presidency in the 1980s. But he allowed some liberalization after years of authoritarian rule. Under public pressure, he allowed the first direct and free election in the nation's history. Senate candidate Parnell loses custody battle, suspends campaign, byline Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Sean Parnell, the candidate endorsed by former President Donald Trump for U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania, on Monday suspended his campaign after he lost a court fight over custody of his three children, in which the judge said he believed allegations of abuse by Parnell's estranged wife. These were from Denver Post Wire reports. Nations tighten rules, protests erupting as virus sweeps through Europe, by Stephen Erlinger, The New York Times Company, byline Brussels. Austria went into a major lockdown Monday to try to break the strong fourth wave of COVID-19 spreading across Europe, while the German health minister, Jens Spahn, warned that by the end of this winter, just about everyone in Germany will probably either be vaccinated, recovered, or dead. Immunity will be reached, Spahn said at a Berlin news conference. The question is whether it's via vaccination or infection, and we explicitly recommend the path via vaccination. European governments are toughening their measures against COVID-19 in the face of soaring infection rates, more than 2 million new cases each week, the most since the pandemic began, and popular resistance with violent protests over the weekend in numerous countries. Tens of thousands of people protested official crackdowns and vaccine requirements in Austria, the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Italy, Switzerland, and Croatia, with scattered violence and police use of tear gas and water cannons. Some protesters were organized by far-right parties, but many were simply fed up with almost 2 years of intermittent state controls over their lives in the name of public health. Ahmed Abu Taleb, mayor of Rotterdam, Netherlands, where some of the worst protests erupted, called them an orgy of violence and said football hooligans were believed to have been involved. Mark Rutte, the Dutch prime minister, defended the right to demonstrate. But what I will never accept is that idiots use sheer violence against the people who work for you and me every day to keep this country safe under the guise of, we are dissatisfied. Europe is once again the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic, accounting for more than half the world's reported COVID-19 deaths this month, according to the World Health Organization. The four countries with the world's highest rates of reported new cases in the past week are Austria and three that border it, Slovakia, Slovenia, and the Czech Republic. 27 of the top 29 are in Europe. With vaccination rates lagging and winter approaching, more governments are ringing alarm bells. Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany told her Christian Democratic Party on Monday that the situation is highly dramatic and that the latest surge is worse than anything Germany had suffered so far. In what may be her last month as chancellor, as a new government is being formed, she warned that hospitals would soon be overwhelmed unless the fourth wave of the virus is broken and called on Germany's 16 states to enforce even tighter restrictions to block the spread. Germany, like many European countries, is at the same time pressing for citizens to get booster shots, but it faces a dwindling supply of the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine, which was partly developed in the country. While the European Medicines Agency is poised to approve the vaccine for use on children ages 5 to 11 this week, first doses for children are not scheduled to be delivered to European Union countries until December 20th, Spahn said. On Thursday, 553,000 vaccines were administered in Germany in one day, a daily total not seen since early August. Three-quarters of those shots were boosters, according to the health ministry. Neighboring Austria on Monday began its fourth lockdown, one of the few in Western Europe since vaccines became widely available. Most stores, restaurants, sporting venues, and cultural institutions shut, leaving the streets cold and quiet in the weeks before Christmas. The lockdown, which only allows people to leave home to go to work or to procure groceries or medicines, will last at least 10 days and as many as 20. Austria has also announced that vaccination will be compulsory as of February 1st, the first Western country to take that step, and one of only a handful around the world. Some critics, including the editorial board of the Financial Times, have called it too high a price in terms of individual freedom and a sign of political failure. Opposition to the measures has been led in Austria by the far-right Freedom Party, the third largest in parliament, which has been amplifying conspiracy theories about the vaccines, spreading doubt about their effectiveness, and promoting ivermectin, a drug typically used to treat parasitic worms, mostly in horses, that has repeatedly failed against the coronavirus in clinical trials. Alexander Schallenberg, Austria's chancellor, said he originally had opposed compulsory vaccination, but we have too many political forces, flimsy vaccine skeptics, and spreaders of fake news in this country. On Saturday, some 40,000 Austrians marched in Vienna to protest the new measures. France presents a contrast in that President Emmanuel Macron has used more suasion. Proof of vaccination or a recent negative test is required to patronize restaurants and cinemas, which has encouraged many reluctant French to get vaccinated without a national mandate. But anti-vaccination groups remain active in France as well. About 68% of Germans and 66% of Austrians have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19, and hospitals are mostly filled with those who have not been vaccinated at all. Early in the pandemic, scientists thought 70 to 80% vaccination might be enough for a population to reach herd immunity, but the virus is now so widespread, with new variants arising and some vaccinated people suffering breakthrough infections, that many experts say herd immunity is unattainable. Interstate 25, South Gap, nears its end. New lanes to open next month as three-year project is almost finished, by John Murray, The Denver Post. A much smoother ride between Castle Rock and Monument is in store for drivers on Interstate 25 next month as new express lanes open, bringing an end to more than 3 years of traffic shifts, tight lanes, and construction backups. The $419 million I-25 South Gap project added a managed toll lane in each direction to two existing lanes over the 18-mile stretch. Crews also rebuilt several bridges and interchanges, added four wildlife crossings, added extra lanes on Monument Hill, and widened the highway's shoulders. Initially, no tolls will be charged in the express lanes during testing. By mid-December, in time for Christmas, the I-25 South Gap project team will open all lanes of travel in their final alignment, with an express lane fully open in both directions, Governor Jared Polis said during a news conference at a truck chain-up station near Larkspur. The event was live-streamed online by the Colorado Department of Transportation. The corridor long was known as I-25 South Gap because it served as a bottleneck between newer sections of the highway that had more lanes. The project has been one of CDOT's lengthiest construction corridors in recent years. Several speakers touted that all lanes will be open an entire year earlier than originally projected, as Polis put it, but that slightly overstates how far ahead of schedule the milestone is. While completion was set for November 2022, the schedule always included months of equipment testing in open lanes before tolling began. More work is planned through the winter and spring, including final paving, striping, and landscaping. But the new lanes still are opening more than 6 months early. CDOT spokesman Matt Inzeo pointed out that aggressive scheduling and warm fall weather helped lead contractor Cramer North America not only to catch up with the original schedule, despite an early project delay caused by unstable soil, but to finish early, even after CDOT expanded the scope of work. The original budget was $350 million, with local governments in El Paso and Douglas counties contributing 10% of the cost. Later, when more funding was available, CDOT added components that included additional bridges and a truck climbing lane, increasing the budget to $419 million. CDOT says the expanded project is coming in on budget. 85,000 motorists travel the gap daily, and now they will have improved safety and mobility, Colorado Springs Mayor John Suthers said. The additional lane will provide travel reliability well into the future and promote multimodal travel, moving more people with fewer accidents. U.S. Senators John Hickenlooper and Michael Bennett also were on hand. The project broke ground when Hickenlooper was Colorado's governor. I remember being here in September 2018 when we kicked this thing off, he said. The South Gap project, we were making jokes about how in London they say mind the gap, while people between Denver and Colorado Springs were sick of minding the gap. Tolling likely won't begin in the express lanes until next fall, Pola said. Similar to express lanes on US 36, C 470, and I-25 north of Denver, toll rates will fluctuate at different times with an aim of keeping vehicles moving in those lanes, even if the general lanes are congested. They also will function as carpool lanes with no tolls for motorcyclists or drivers of vehicles with at least three people inside, though a special express toll transponder likely will be needed. The rate schedule hasn't been finalized yet. More than 3,200 people have worked on-site during the project, CDOT Executive Director Shoshana Liu said. Brighton. Council member faces probe. Special prosecutor will investigate an official's incident with law enforcement, by John Aguilar, the Denver Post. The Brighton City Council on Monday night appointed a special prosecutor to probe the conduct of one of its council members for potential ethical or municipal code violations, but then refused to identify which elected official it is having investigated. The vote to hire the law firm of Wilson Williams LLP to determine whether a council member has violated any municipal laws or ethical standards such that prosecution is warranted was 8-0. The only council member who did not attend Monday's meeting or vote on the resolution was Chris Giordanelli, who was censured by his colleagues last year following a disjointed rant he gave during a virtual council meeting, words he attributed to being under the influence of alcohol and medication. Attempts to reach Giordanelli Monday night at several listed phone numbers and via email were unsuccessful. Asked why Brighton City Council would hold a public meeting about the conduct of one of its members but declined to name who that person was, Mayor Gregory Mills said, "I welcome transparency. However, because there is an active investigation, I am being advised to not comment at this time." City spokeswoman Kristen Chernowski said after consulting with the city attorney, "We are unable to confirm the name of the council member while it is under investigation." The probe stems from an incident on August 17th, during which the unidentified council member was contacted by police who wanted to discuss an incident with him after he was walked home with supervision from a city council meeting, according to a memo attached to Monday's special meeting. The council member was referred to in the memo by a male pronoun. He allegedly told a Brighton police officer that, "You don't want to mess with me," while referencing his status as a city council member, the memo states. Brighton police officers are employees of the city and subordinate to the city manager, the memo reads. Threats made to officers on scene could be considered an attempt to interfere with the performance of the officer's responsibilities, attempting to use your city council position for personal gain or advantage could be considered a violation of the Municipal Code of Ethics. The Denver Post sent open records requests seeking the police report from the August 17th incident to the city manager's office and to the Brighton Police Department ahead of the meeting Monday, but did not receive the report by the end of the day. It's not clear why police were trying to contact the council member in the first place and why it took more than 3 months for the incident to come to light. This is not the first time Brighton's city council and top leadership have made headlines in recent years. In September 2020, Brighton City Council censured Giordinelli for his behavior during a virtual council meeting, behavior so bizarre that his colleagues agreed to send someone to his house to check up on him. They cited conduct that is inconsistent with the values and ideals of the council or the city of Brighton. Giordinelli, who was elected to his seat in November 2019, and whose term runs until January 2024, said during that meeting that he grew up on a farm and saw animals eat each other. I had cops who were my buddies, and a cat will eat the brain of an old lady, so this conversation is just pissing me off, he said during the meeting. I may get recalled over it, and I don't care. He later apologized for his comments. While Giordinelli never faced recall, former mayor Ken Kreutzer did. Kreutzer lost his seat 2 years ago after a movement against him blossomed, following the Brighton Council's decision that summer to fire the city manager, who said at the time of his dismissal that he was being let go because he discovered unnecessarily high water rates being charged to residents. Last month, Brighton hired a new city manager following the resignation of Jane Baez de Sissa in early October, after she held the position for barely a year. Michael Martinez was named as her replacement. And weeks after the November 2nd election, the composition of Brighton's council is still not fully settled because none of the candidates running for mayor received a majority of support from voters. The two top vote-getters, Mills and Lori D. Lozano Meyer, will have to duel it out in a runoff election December 7th. Thanksgiving. Holiday traffic likely up at DIA. By John Murray, The Denver Post. Denver International Airport has added back some security screening capacity and reopened its low-price shuttle lot, but space crunches still may greet travelers flying before and after Thanksgiving Day. DIA expected holiday traffic to beat pre-pandemic levels, according to an airport news release last week. More than 2 million passengers were forecast to fly in or out of DIA between November 19th and November 30th, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. That would mark a 2.7% increase over the same period 2 years ago. After passengers have faced short parking availability and long security lines in recent months, some stretching 90 minutes or longer at peak times, DIA and the Transportation Security Administration made several changes this month. So far, there's reason for measured optimism. We haven't really seen the level of crazy lines as before, DIA spokeswoman Stephanie Figueroa said Monday, noting that the morning's lines were manageable despite heavy travel. We're hoping that these changes are working. We need a little bit more time to confirm that that's what it is. Here's what you should know before heading to DIA. Make sure to bring both a mask, which federal regulations still require inside airports and on planes, and your patients. How do you find real-time info? The airport on Friday restored a real-time security weights indicator on its website, www.flydenver.com, that shows how much lines are backed up at each of its three screening checkpoints. The indicator had been dropped during the pandemic. The website also provides the status of each parking lot or garage, noting when they're nearing capacity or full. Which days will be the busiest? DIA's airline passenger data show that prior to Thanksgiving, Monday and Wednesday were expected to be the busiest, but the most traffic is expected on Sunday, when 206,000 passengers are expected to travel at the end of the holiday weekend. Next Monday also will be busy, DIA says. When should you arrive? DIA suggests arriving inside the airport at least 2 hours prior to your boarding time, not the flight's departure time, as it used to advise. That should be enough time to check bags and clear security, and the extra cushion is recommended especially if you don't have a TSA pre-check membership or another expedited screening status. Security line lengths fluctuate throughout the day, but typically, owing to flight takeoff patterns, waits tend to be longer from the early morning hours through 10 a.m. and again between 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. What has changed at the security checkpoints? In early November, the airport and the TSA reshuffled the types of lines available at each checkpoint. For general screening, head to the South Main checkpoint on Level 5, nearest to the Westin DIA Hotel and the Transit Center, or to the bridge to Concourse A accessible on Level 6. If you have PreCheck or an airline premium access status, go to the North Main checkpoint on Level 5. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
Students with disabilities in Douglas County want some time after a federal judge ruled last week that a new health order making mask wearing optional in school would put students at risk of irreparable harm. But with a new conservative-leaning school board set to take over at the end of the month, that reprieve could be short-lived. David Monroe with Disability Law Colorado says if the new board decides to embrace the health order, students and families would be back at square one.
What's at stake here is the right for especially students with disabilities to have a right to get the same public education every other child does, but to get that education in an atmosphere which is safe to them, does not compromise or jeopardize their health.
Families of students with disabilities and the Douglas County School District took the county's new health department to court, arguing that making masks optional was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered the health department to stop enforcement of the order for 14 days. County health officials disagreed with the judge's decision and claimed the order strikes the right balance between public health and parental choice. Children with disabilities frequently face serious health challenges, and Monroe says many parents pulled their kids out of school during COVID surges, uncertain if mask mandates were being followed. But when kids aren't in school, Monroe says they're losing out on their right to an appropriate public education.
There are children who have had health issues that may leave them immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. They can be at a much higher risk of having a very serious health outcome if they get COVID.
Douglas County School District's president welcomed the court's temporary restraining order and said in a statement that no one should have to choose between sending their children to school and putting their health at risk. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Did you know that vapes and e-cigarettes may not be as safe as you think? It is not harmless water vapor. The aerosol emitted from e-cigarettes is a mix of chemicals that may cause harm to human bodies. This includes nicotine, nanoparticles, heavy metals, and flavorings known to cause respiratory disease. It is not an FDA-approved cessation device. E-cigarettes are not approved for cessation of cigarettes at this time. Only approved nicotine products with counseling have been proven to help people quit all tobacco products for good. E-cigarettes are not regulated. At this time, there are no standard regulations for e-cigarette products. This means that the exact ingredients or how they are made are unknown. Nicotine is present in almost all products. Though some products may claim to be nicotine-free, no regulation means there is no way to show that these claims are true. Also, there are still chemicals in e-liquids that may be harmful to the human body. Nicotine is addictive. Using tobacco products has been considered a nasty habit for too long. The truth is that nicotine in tobacco products is addictive. It can change biology and, if left untreated, can last a lifetime. Nicotine can harm the developing brain. The brain is still developing until about the age of 25. Nicotine can disrupt brain development and cause impulsive behaviors and difficulty focusing. When young people use nicotine, they are susceptible to a lifetime of addiction. Flavors attract kids. Though some adults may enjoy using products flavored like cotton candy or gummy bears, many of the e-liquids are meant to taste like childhood favorites of young people. Big tobacco plays a role. Big tobacco companies who have a history of putting sales above safety own shares of many vape companies. This message was brought to you by the Tri-County Health Department. For more information, please visit tchd.org/e-cigs.
AINC programming is brought to you in part by Trendware, Colorado's best full-service IT managed services and purpose-built computer device provider.